You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Carrie Nolan here today for Leonard Lopate, and we are waiting the arrival of Victor Cha. He's the author of a book called Beyond the Final Score, and it's all about how politics has transformed things in Asia. And we thought it was an ideal time to talk about it with the Olympic Games in their final days. When he arrives, we'll talk all about his book. But now I want to ask you a couple of questions. For you, have the Olympic spectacles changed your mind about China's role in the world? Give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. In watching the opening ceremonies, did that change your mind? Watching that little girl, as it turns out, lip-syncing the Chinese national anthem, did that change the way you thought about things? And have the Olympics in China brought any kind of new focus in your view to the human rights issue in China? 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Michael Phelps, 8 gold medals, the showdown between the American and Chinese gymnastics teams. They have all been part of the spectacle, if you will. Joining us now is Victor D. Cha, author of Beyond the Final Score, The Politics of Sport in Asia. The book is published by Columbia University Press. I'm delighted that it brings him to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome, Victor.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for doing the show. So we were just talking about the high ratings of the show, the spectacle, all of the pageantry and the pomp. Are you surprised at all by the high ratings?
No, I'm not surprised by the high ratings at all. I think, you know, in sort of the history of the modern Olympics, these are by far the biggest games, the most expensive games ever. And it's become not just a big event in Olympic history, it's become a big event in many ways in world history. You know, over 80 leaders or heads of state attended the opening ceremonies. I mean, all these things are unprecedented in terms of the history of the Olympics. So the high ratings that we're having here in the United States are not surprising. I think that's also been in good part a function of the fact that the U.S. athletes and teams are performing quite well at the games.
What does it say about China's role in the wider world that so many world leaders did come to those opening ceremonies?
Well, I think in China's eyes, it was probably for them a sign of respect that they have long been seeking from the international system in terms of China's place in the world. I think they view these Olympics, and it's almost a cliche phrase now, as a huge coming out party for China in a long history in which they feel they have been put upon, divided, conquered, and after, you know, years, if not centuries, China has arrived as a global player, as a modern industrious nation, and I feel that they see this as their moment in the sun.
Well, I'm wondering how much of that is spectacle, how much of that is marketing, and, you know, at what cost to human rights does China's coming out party
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of it, this is sort of the way China wants to brand themselves. But I think when you talk about the political side of it, the branding is, in their eyes, it's about how great they are. Everybody wants to see China, modern industrialized nation. But the other part that comes with the branding is more political responsibility. And I think here, this is, I talk about in the book, this is sort of where the Chinese leadership may have bitten off more than they can chew. Because being a global player requires you also to be more responsible. If you're a stakeholder in the system, you need to be more responsible as a stakeholder in the system. And this is where China has faced a lot of pressure in the run-up to the games to provide more access to media, to change their policies in different parts of the world where they follow sort of unconditional policies of development assistance and energy trade, as well as improve their own domestic human rights situation.
Why is it In your book, you talk about, the subtitle is The Politics of Sport in Asia. Why do sports play such a large role in Asia and as well as Asian politics?
It's a good question. I think that, it's a given that sports are important everywhere. But I argue that they're politically more important in Asia for a couple of reasons. One is that these big sporting events rarely come to Asia. If you look at the Olympics, for example, the Summer Olympics the modern Summer Olympics have been around since 1896. In all of that time, they've only come to Asia three times. 1964 in Tokyo, Japan, 1988 in Seoul, Korea, and 2008 in Beijing, China. By comparison, the cities of London and Paris, if you go out to 2012, will have hosted the games a total of five times between the two cities. So it literally is a huge event when it comes to Asia, and I think that makes it more political. Another reason is because I think the pace of change in Asia is so rapid. What it took countries in the West half a century or a century to do happens in Asia in decades. Countries go from post-war agrarian economies or post-war colonial societies, to OECD countries, within a period of 30 years. And what that means when things like the Olympics come is that they become very big nation-building events where the countries use the hook of hosting the world as the opportunity to show the world how modern and industrious they are. And I think for that reason, they become incredibly important in Asia politically and in terms of national identity.
We're speaking with Victor D. Cha, the author of Beyond the Final Score. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Leonard Lopate. Do you think that this is one of the reasons the International Olympic Committee chose Beijing to host the Olympics, kind of welcoming the new power player to the table? Or did Beijing just sort of take the bull by the horns and say, no, now we are a power player?
Probably a combination of the two. I mean, China's interest in the Olympics clearly predated the bid for the 2008 Games. They actually bid for the 2000 Games in 1993. And they didn't win the bid. They were one of the two finalist candidate cities, Beijing and Sydney, and Sydney won the Olympics. So I think the Chinese felt that this was part of their growth as a nation, that they had to host this major event. I think for the organizers in the Olympic movement, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, I think there was a sense that the Olympics cannot bypass the biggest country in the world, and that sooner or later it had to come to China. I think what was most interesting about the bid in 1993 was there were clearly many in the IOC and on the potential corporate sponsorship side that wanted to see the games come to Beijing. But the memory of Tiananmen Square was still too vivid in the minds of many folks. And for that reason, I think one of the reasons why Sydney won the bid. But I think at this point, the memories of Tiananmen have faded. They have not gone away. And I think many saw this as an opportunity both to recognize China's place, but also to impart upon them greater expectations and higher obligations in terms of their international policies as well as their domestic policies.
Well, China's human rights record is still under scrutiny, to be a little understating on that.
Right. That's right.
I just wonder, in giving them this big gift of the Olympics, what obligation do they really have to change anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, technically they don't. They don't have any obligation to change anything. But I think what they face, which I talk about in the book, is they face a fundamental catch-22 with these games, which is that, they sought out these games to show the world what a great country they are, their place in the world, responsible stakeholder, and all of that. But there's a price that comes with that Olympic limelight, and the price is tremendous pressure and heightened expectations for more responsible policies, both at home and abroad. And if the Chinese do not accede to some of that pressure, then the fundamental purpose of having the games, which is to show the world what a great country China is, gets undercut. So I think in this sense, they have faced pressure in terms of their foreign policy and domestic policy that they've never faced before, and scrutiny that the Communist Party of China has never faced before, since 1949, and it has led to some results. I mean, not. I wouldn't call them fantastic results, but they have led to some results in terms of policies in Africa, as well as in parts of Southeast Asia, and in terms of media access.
Now, you know, didn't it cause them somewhat, though, to hide rather than halt the human rights violations that are coming under such scrutiny?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms, I should make a clear distinction, in terms of the externalization of their human rights violations in foreign policy, they faced a lot of pressure there, and we have seen some changes. One example has been policy towards Sudan, Darfur, where the Chinese have really, the New York Times once described it as sort of a quiet revolution in China's policy towards Darfur because of pre-Olympics pressure that years of diplomacy could not accomplish. But in terms of their domestic human rights and the way they treat their dissidents and political expression of freedom of home, we haven't seen a whole lot of change there. So the record is certainly mixed, but I would not say that the Olympics has caused no political change in China, because it certainly has, and I think it will in the future as well.
Well, now, didn't foreign journalists have really limited internet access? They were blocked from sites like Amnesty International and the Chinese versions of both Germany's Deutsche Welle and the BBC.
Yes. I mean, there were, in the run-up to the Games, there were big promises that were made by the Chinese in terms of unfettered press access, much more so than what foreign journalists and media were allowed to have prior to the Beijing Olympics, and there were some concerns initially about media access to certain internet sites and things, and that continues to be a problem. But fundamentally, you know, these Olympics will have brought, by the time they finish next week, some 20,000 journalists to China, 10,000 freelancers, and I'm not sure the exact number now, but the estimates are 500,000 tourists, all with cell phone cameras. And that is a level of scrutiny that China has never experienced before, and they cannot control for it, which is why I think after these games, because of that level of scrutiny, China just won't be the same place. And I think expectations among folks in the world, as well as within China, among Chinese people, will change because of that level of scrutiny that they underwent, will have undergone.
Let's talk a little bit more about that after we take a break. I'm speaking with Victor Cha, the author of Beyond the Final Score, published by Columbia University Press. We do have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard Lopate, and we're speaking with Victor Cha, who's the author of Beyond the Final Score, The Politics of Sport in Asia, published by Columbia University Press. And just before the break, we were talking a little bit about the level of scrutiny that Beijing has come under with the advent of the Olympics and tens of thousands of journalists, both freelance and network, and about 500,000 tourists who have all shown up, who all have cell phones, as you pointed out, Victor, and those cell phones all have cameras. And this is not the kind of scrutiny that the Chinese government has been used to since the revolution. So let's talk a little bit about what might happen once all these people go home.
Well, I think there will be an impulse among some in the leadership in China to walk back some of the changes that they have made, the changes they've made to make the society and policy more open after the spotlight of the Olympics dims. But I think what they're not anticipating is that every change that they have made in the run-up to the games does not happen in a static environment. Every change that they make creates higher expectations in the world and among the Chinese people for more openness. So the notion that they could simply walk back everything that they did prior to the games You know, as soon as the final event of the Paralympics, which follows the regular Olympics, when that ends in October, that they can simply walk everything back. It's not going to be that easy for the Chinese leadership to do that, even if they wanted to. And I think that this is why it's going to be a fundamentally different situation in China after these games.
In your book, Beyond the Final Score, you write about a slippery slope of political change that China's now on.
Yes. I mean, I think in political science, what we talk about is how change begets more change. And in the case of China, if we look, for example, at their policies in Darfur, they came under tremendous pressure in the run-up to the games from media, from entertainers, from NGOs, about what was essentially an unconditional policy in Sudan, where they would support the regime for reasons of energy resources, regardless of what was happening in Darfur. They came under tremendous pressure from folks like Mia Farrow, other groups. Steven Spielberg resigned in his role as an artistic consultant to the opening of the games, and were forced to really deal with their policies in a way that they had never had to deal with them before. For this reason, the Chinese became less obstructionist in terms of UN Security Council resolutions on Darfur over the past 7 months. Our former special envoy on Darfur, Andrew Natsios, testified in Congress that the Chinese had been helpful in getting the regime in Khartoum to accept the African Union UN peacekeeping operation. The Chinese even contributed forces to that operation. Real changes in policy. Now, by no means are we saying that China's perfect on this. They still have a long way to go. But the point is when they make those changes in the spotlight of the Olympics, the expectations upon China heighten for them to do more. So even after they did all the things that I just mentioned, Spielberg still resigned as artistic director. Mm-hmm. Archbishop Desmond Tutu still made a public statement about how the Chinese need to do more. This is the slippery slope that they're on, especially if they want to convey this message to the world through the Olympics that they are a global power, you know, a responsible player. They create this slippery slope for themselves, and I think this is sort of the thing that they have not really thought about as carefully as they got completely focused on the preparations for the games. And I think that's a good news story for political change in China.
What place does sports have then in say international diplomacy? Is it sort of the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that in certain cases it can be very helpful in terms of promoting diplomacy. It is an unconventional tool. It is not sort of your average State Department or Foreign Ministry demarche, and it has a way of creating goodwill. Creating a groundswell of public opinion for more positive turns in relationships between countries in ways that you would not expect through normal diplomacy. I think the sort of standard example out there is the case of ping pong and the U.S.-China relationship in the 1970s, where this invitation for the U.S. national table tennis team, when they were participating in the World Championships in Japan, to then go on to Beijing for exhibition matches. All this was happening at a time when Nixon and Kissinger were working behind the scenes to open a relationship with China. And where I think the ping pong, I mean, I think contrary to what people think, ping pong didn't create the breakthrough in U.S.-China relations. There were a lot of efforts by Nixon and Kissinger behind the scenes to do this that were happening at the same time. But what ping pong diplomacy did was it created a groundswell of not just U.S. opinion, but world opinion in support of an opening of relations between these two major countries. And that in many ways was very, very good because it helped to overcome some of the entrenched bureaucratic interests in both countries that might have been against moving forward in the way that the United States and China did. And in the book, I go through other examples of this and where sports has been important in terms of diplomacy. And the other way I think sports has been important in terms of politics and international relations has been in terms of national identity. These events become extremely important for how a country sees itself in the world, how it wants to be seen in the world. It's, you know, the obvious deduction is that it's related to patriotism and nationalism, and that's certainly true. But sport has played a very important role in terms of uniting nations. I talk in the book about the case of Yemen and the unification of Yemen, and how the Football League and the United Football League in Yemen was a very important symbol of uniting the two countries, much more so than the sort of union of the nameless and faceless bureaucracies in the two Yemeni governments. Mm-hmm. Uniting the two football teams was hugely important. And one example I actually give in the book, which I think many of your listeners in New York would could relate to, and I'm a native New Yorker, so I put this one in, was you try to understand why sport would matter that much in terms of how the people relate. And, you know, I take this far-fetched example of, can you imagine if the cities of New York and Boston were to somehow merge? People wouldn't really care, or most people wouldn't care about
Yankees and Red Sox fans,
right,
would care.
This is exactly the point. I mean, people don't care if the port authorities of New York and Boston merge, but they would be intensely interested in the merger of the Yankees and the Boston Red Sox. And if that is not carried out in a way that is useful to both sides, then it dramatically affects everybody's public perception of this new political union. And that in Yemen, that was exactly where football was actually very important for uniting the two countries. Other examples were Germany, looking at North and South Korea. All these are very interesting cases.
We're talking with Victor Cha, the author of Beyond the Final Score, The Politics of Sport in Asia. And I'm Carrie Nolan, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC New York and WNYC.org, by the way. You describe in your book four key marks that China needed to hit to demonstrate success in hosting the Games. Can you tell us what those are?
Sure. I think for them, in the minds of the Chinese, what they need to be successful in terms of these Games is, first, their athletes have to perform well in terms of the medal count. And here, I think, I think where they are now, it depends on whether you count gold medals or overall medals.
Well, right now, I can tell you that China leads in the gold, 46-28.
Right.
We lead in the overall medals.
Right, yeah. Right. So, the Chinese, it's absolutely critical. If this is part of their ability to show the world they are strong, they are great, you know, all this, then they have to be number one or number two in the overall medal count. That's one very important factor. The other, I think, is the manner in which they host the Games. A very important component of being the host city of the Games is you have to host them well. And the standard here, I think, is the standard that was set in Sydney in 2000, which were universally acclaimed as a very well-hosted Games. Unfortunately, the standard that they don't want to aspire to is the standard that was set in Atlanta in 1996, where there were quite a bit of complaints about the logistics of the Games. Thus far, the Chinese seem to be doing okay on this. I mean, there were some concerns initially about ticket sales, but they seem to be doing okay. Third mark is the environment and air. One of the biggest stories and topics in the run-up to the Games, the Chinese have invested some $17 billion into trying to clean up the air and the environment in Beijing for these Games. Very important mark for them. What they don't want is a lot of the concerns that were raised by the IOC and others about how some of the longer endurance events might have to be postponed because of air quality, these sorts of things. And then finally, again, from the Chinese perspective, the fourth mark they want to hit for them to be successful is to try to marginalize the political protest as much as they can. They were clearly unsuccessful in terms of doing that in the run-up to the Games with the international legs of the torch procession in London, Paris, San Francisco, Seoul, and some other places. But I think, and I don't say this in a good sense, I think they have been successful in terms of marginalizing a lot of the political protests once the Games started. And that is not a good news story for a lot of the NGOs and other groups that wanted to, and domestic NGOs in China as well, that wanted to use these Games as an opportunity to show the world some of the problems that exist in this country.
Now, weren't people banned from even going to designated protest sites?
Yeah. I mean, the Chinese in the run-up to the Games designated certain protest areas in which you would be free to express your political opinion, but you needed to apply. You needed to do it there, and you needed to apply for a permit. I think what some of the groups who have found is that they have found these areas, and they have applied for the permit, and they've run into basically miles of bureaucratic red tape where they're either not getting the permit, or they're getting deported, or they're getting detained. And this, interestingly enough, has not been as big a news story since the start of the games as one might have expected. And I think in part it's because once the game started, the sports took over. And it became the main story of the Olympics, were the sports. And the political stuff kind of got pushed to the side, where prior to the games, the politics were the main story of the Olympics. And I think what you're seeing now, I think this week, is that as things like Michael Phelps's gold medal run has finished with the end of the swimming events, is that as you get a lull in sort of the coverage of a lot of the big stories in terms of performance, you're seeing more of the stories about the politics and the political protests starting to come out now.
Do you think we'll go back to talking about politics in China once the games end, or will we move on to other issues in the world? You know, Olympics over, you know.
Well, I think in terms of the people like myself who focus on China, U.S.-China relations, China's place in the world, and U.S. policy in Asia, this will continue to be a very important issue. And again, this notion of maintaining a high level of expectations in terms of what China needs to do will certainly be a topic of conversation. I think depending on what happens in these Olympics, in the days that remain, particularly if there is something political that happens, you know, we will go straight from these Olympic Games into the conventions in the United States, and that will make China an issue in the conventions if something untoward happens in the remaining days of the Olympics. But the other thing that I think many of the Chinese organizers of the Games probably see as working to their advantage in terms of marginalizing the protests or the stories about protests has been what's been happening in Russia, in Georgia, because that has sort of been the center of world news attention and has taken a lot of the politics spotlight off of the Games, which the Chinese organizers probably see as a godsend.
Now, you were the director of Asian Affairs on the National Security Council. You were deputy head of the U.S. delegation to the six-party talks. How does that experience affect your perspective on the role of sport in foreign relations?
I spent 3 years taking a public service leave from my university at Georgetown to work on the NSC, and I found that in particular on the sporting side, where sports was most useful in terms of diplomacy when you had things that were starting to move in the right direction in terms of improving relations, you know, trying to get a breakthrough on a particular negotiation, when things were moving in the right direction, and then you had a fortuitous sporting event that could then accelerate the process, create some goodwill, allow for the clarification of intentions on both sides, then it was particularly useful. If you had no movement at all on the diplomatic front, then it's very difficult for sporting events to really create a breakthrough in and of themselves. You know, one case that's always given is you look at the relationship between the United States and Iran. There have been past attempts to try to create breakthroughs, diplomatic breakthroughs, through invitations to American sporting delegations to go to Iran. But if there is no sort of undercurrent of actual policy activities that are moving in the direction of a breakthrough, it's hard for those things to create breakthroughs. You know, another example is the United States and Cuba with regard to baseball. You know, these sporting events have to come at a particular time when the currents are moving in the right direction, as they were in the case of ping pong diplomacy in the United States and China, for them to really make a difference.
Now, the 2014 Winter Games are scheduled to be held in Sochi, Russia, and the 2010 World Cup is going to be in South Africa. Do you think we can expect a focus on human rights in those venues?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could have two very different stories. I mean, in the case of 2014 and Sochi, Russia. I think, well, it's hard to say where we'll be at that point in terms of U.S.-Russian relations, but I think that there will be very similar sorts of pressures that the organizers and the government will face that the Chinese faced in the run-up to the games. And this isn't something that happens only over a period of several months. This is 7 years in the run-up to the games, where they will face all sorts of pressures for political change. Many groups will use the Olympic spotlight to try to highlight flaws in the Russian system and groups that have been repressed as a result of policies. And I think that, you know, if China is any example, some of that pressure will be effective in terms of creating some change in that country. The 2010 World Cup in South Africa will be a very interesting story, because in many ways, sports, if there's one case where sports really played a role in affecting political change domestically, you could argue that it was in South Africa. In large part because of the international ban that was placed on South Africa because of their apartheid policies. And it wasn't simply the ban by the Olympic Committee, International Olympic Committee. It was really the ban when it came to international rugby that was very important and significant for the South Africans in terms of their own identity and place in the world.
This is all this the world of sport and politics continues to fascinate me. I really enjoyed the book. Victor Cha, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Victor D. Cha, the author of Beyond the Final Score. It's published by Columbia University Press. And once again, thank you so much for being with us.